Welcome to the High Velocity Radio Show. High Velocity Radio is brought to you by PSI Digital Media Experts, the market leader in delivering digital media services. From manufacturing millions of CDs and DVDs to turnkey e-commerce solutions and streaming high-definition video over their worldwide content distribution network, PSI has the solutions to meet your needs. Find PSI at psidiscs.com, psidiscs.com. The High Velocity Radio Show is where we celebrate innovative professionals producing better results in less time. Produced and directed by Lee Cantor and brought to you live from Radio X Studio in Atlanta, Georgia. Now here are your hosts, Todd Schnick and Stone Payton.
Welcome to the High Velocity Radio Show. This is your host, Stone Payton, coughing in the background. And joining me in the studio this morning is Lee Cantor, our producer, and my good buddy, Todd Schnick. How are you, Todd?
I'm fine, Stone. I'm trying to get a handle on this weather. I played tennis on Saturday and it was 76 and sunny. Ran 10 miles yesterday and it was rainy and gale force winds, and then this morning there's snow.
There was snow this morning. Can you believe that?
I cannot get a handle on it.
So tell us about the funky watch, man. Is that some kind of runner gadget?
Oh, this is my Nike running watch. I just forgot to take it off from yesterday.
Very cool.
It's kind of large and obnoxious, but it keeps good time.
Well, get us caught up on the running thing, and then what else did happen for you last week?
Oh gosh, just 1 month ago, believe it or not, until I run this marathon in Nashville at the end of April, and just yesterday was another one of our long runs. It's 10 miles. Ran down Peachtree, kicked Cardiac Hill's ass. It was a great day. We'll run 11 miles next weekend, 12 the next, and then I begin to taper back before we hit the full half marathon in late April.
Well, I'm impressed, man, and I'm pulling for you.
I appreciate that.
I won't be anywhere near there, but I'll be thinking of you.
Good. Well, we need all the support we can get.
And this happens on a Saturday?
Saturday, I think April 24th, if I'm not mistaken, up in Nashville.
Okay. Well, I'll be watching cartoons, but you'll be in my heart and my prayers, man.
I appreciate that.
Well, we've got a great show this morning. Here a little bit later in the program, we're going to hear from Theo Gilbert Jameson. I believe she's on her way from over in Conyers and probably fighting the terrain that we all know so well between here in Conyers and probably trying to work her way around 285. So we're going to hear from her in a little while. But first up on the High Velocity Radio Show this morning is a veteran commercial freelancer and business coach. He's a self-publishing author of the award-winning Well-Fed Writer titles on lucrative commercial franchise. Let me try that again. He's a self-publishing author of the award-winning Well-Fed Writer titles on lucrative commercial freelancing, writing for companies and for hourly rates of $50 to $125 or more. Back in 1993, with no industry experience, no previous paid writing experience, and no writing background, this gentleman built a commercial freelancing business from fantasy to full-time in less than 4 months. Please join me in welcoming to the show Mr. Peter Bowerman. Welcome to the show, Peter.
Thank you, Stone. Great to be here.
Well, we are delighted to have you. So how in the world do you go from not knowing a thing in the world about this stuff to being successful in the world of writing?
Well, it takes it's not an overnight process, but I always wanted to be a writer, but I wasn't willing to do it on the cheap. And the idea of being a starving writer never really appealed to me too much. And I came across a book back in the early 90s, the only book on the subject, actually at the time, about commercial freelancing. And who knew that companies actually hire people from the outside to handle their writing projects? You would just assume that it would all be done in-house. And I thought, aha, this is how I'm going to do it. And so I launched my business in early 94, and as you pointed out, I actually was paying all my bills in about 4 months, and it's just kind of grown from there, because there's a big need in the business world for good writers, and there's a lot of good, sound economic reasons why a business would go outside to get their help as opposed to doing it in-house.
So. It's funny that you say, you know, I didn't want to be a starving writer. Why do all artists think that it's honorable to be starving?
Yeah, there's something about this poverty is nobility sort of trip. And hey, if it makes you feel better to stay one step ahead of the landlady and eat beans out of the can and all that, more power to you. But I guess I'm one of those who actually like to have a house and a relatively late model car and take a few nights vacations a year and put money in the bank and stay out of debt and all that. So call me crazy. but the interesting thing about this is that, you know, I often tell people this is a great field if you're a writer, because it'll give you the time and the space to pursue your creative writing passions. You know, if you're making $100 an hour, you don't have to be working 50 or 60 hours a week to make a good living. So, and in essence, that's kind of what I did. I used the business to finance my book writing, both in the time and the money that it took to do it. So.
One of my favorite bloggers is a guy named Hugh McLeod. He's probably better known as the guy who writes cartoons on the back of business cards. In fact, the art on the back of my card. He's an artist. And you define an artist as someone who changes the way you think, the way you behave, the way you act. It affects you profoundly or emotionally. And so he's been doing this for a long, long time. And he's an artist. But he occasionally does work, commission work for large organizations. And all the community says, oh, you're selling out. You're an artist. You're not supposed to be doing that kind of thing. And he's like, I call bunk on that.
Exactly.
It's about earning a living, but you still can make art.
Well, and this whole idea, and I just get such a kick out of this whole idea of that, you know, how much of a sellout it is. And as if, you know, anytime you're writing for a company, you're lying, you know, or you're stretching the truth somehow. Or the other one is that I love is, well, I couldn't write about anything I didn't believe in. And it's like, can you believe in fiber optics? You know, could you believe in, siding? I mean, you know, let's not get melodramatic about this. I mean, sure, if there's something like tobacco or alcohol or whatever that you have some philosophical objection to, fine, don't write for those companies, you know. But it is pretty funny. And frankly, it's a way to make a good living and write for a living if writing is your thing.
How do you get over the challenge of people saying, oh, the company is hiring you shouldn't be hiring a ghostwriter? I get that same issue with some of my clients who I do some social media work for. And I am intimately involved in the details of these businesses.
Right.
I mean, I've been with them a long, long time. And I don't feel it's ghostwriting. I feel like I'm part of their family.
Yeah, and it isn't really ghostwriting in a strict sense. But, you know, there, as I hinted at earlier, there's some good, solid economic reasons why a company would hire someone from the outside. Some obvious ones, some less obvious ones. The obvious ones, of course, are they don't have to pay salary and benefits and vacation. And of course, people in the working world see that as a negative. Oh, they're getting rid of full-time workers, you know, but the economy gives, the economy takes away kind of thing. The other big thing is they get to buy only what they need, only when they need it. Okay, so they're not having to keep somebody around and working constantly if they can't, you know, fill up the pipeline. They get a wide range of talent. And probably one of the most important things is they get some fresh outside perspectives, because anybody who's worked for a corporation knows how insular and insulated it can get and how that can really be reflected in, you know, you think you know your business and you think that person on the other side understands what you know, and they don't. And it takes someone from the outside to say, you know, you guys are making a lot of assumptions here on the part of a reader. You know, you need to meet them where they are kind of thing.
So. Well, maybe you need a very seasoned expert on fiber optics. And maybe someone some FTE in your organization doesn't have that skill set, and you need that.
Well, and I'm glad you brought that up, because that is one of the best things about this field, is that anyone who's listening out there who, say, comes from fiber optics or telecommunications or retail or financial services or healthcare, or whatever your background, this is one of the most leverageable. You know, you can take just about any field that you've been in and leverage it into the writing business, because no matter what the industry is, things need to get written. And it always helps if you come from that industry. And that actually can trump the lack of a big portfolio. If you go to a company and say, hey, I don't have a huge portfolio, but I know your industry. I've worked in it for 20 years. I know the vernacular. I know the kind of projects you need to create, you know, all that. That's very compelling to a company. So, you know, you don't necessarily have to have been at it a long time as a writer. So
what would be an example or two of a commercial freelance project, and what kind of background experience do you need to be successful in that arena?
Good questions. The way I'd have people think about this is, you know, think about, you know, in the course of doing business, a company has to create an enormous amount of written material. And this is in the course of communicating with both or with clients, with prospects, and with their own employees. So think about all the projects that that might entail: marketing brochures, ad copy, newsletters, websites, direct mail campaigns, web content, case studies, white papers, sales sheets, video scripts. It goes on and on and on and on and on. Again, anything a company would have to create in the course of doing business. As far as what kind of experience is needed for that kind of field, I didn't have any experience writing for business, and I say that if you're a decent writer, if you know that you have good writing skills, you can channel that pretty easily into writing copy for companies. It's not that difficult. People say, "Oh, I'm not a marketer." Well, there's some fundamental, Todd, you know, there's some fundamental cornerstone marketing concepts that things like audience and features and benefits and USP, that if somebody just gets those things down and understands those things, they can communicate intelligently with just about anybody and actually will set themselves apart from most people out there. I mean, you probably know from your experience, and I certainly know from mine, how many companies out there that are quote-unquote successful don't get it right, as far as basic marketing concepts and basic, fundamentals. And if you can, you're going to set yourself apart, both from your competition and in being able to write copy.
See, I challenge that mindset that we're not all marketers.
Right.
First of all, from the business point of view, I think even the janitor in an organization is in the marketing field. But if you have ever had to convince your spouse to see a certain movie or get a certain dinner,
exactly,
or to make something special for dinner, you're in sales and marketing.
Right, right.
And I that's something I always try to convince my clients is that, everything you do has got to be a marketing decision.
Right.
Every decision you make.
Yeah, in the book, I have a chapter in there entitled Learning to Love S&M, sales, sales and marketing, because that's the way people sometimes view it. It's just there's this fear and terror around it, and I maintain, and you probably do as well, that success, whether it be a marketer, in my case a commercial freelancer, is far more about a lot of things you have to do than some way you have to be. It's far more about a process than it is a personality. So,
can you make any real money at this, or is it just something to tide you over till you get your other writing that you want to do?
Oh,
I mean, can you make a really comfortable living at this?
Absolutely, absolutely. Again, as you hinted at in the intro, the most kind intro, the commercial writing field pays on a low end anywhere from $50 to $125 an hour on up. And when I say on up, that's not just marketing hype. When you get very comfortable with a client, let's say you're doing a newsletter for a client, and the first particular issue of it, you're estimating it's going to take you 8 hours, and you're at $125 an hour, so you're charging them $1,000. Okay. Well, as time goes on, that newsletter gets easier and easier to do, but you may be making the same amount of, same basic fee. So maybe now it takes you 5 hours to do. Now you're up to $200 an hour. Okay. Now, are you going to make that kind of money right out of the gate? No. Okay. But this field is, the financial paradigm in this field is vastly different than from newspapers or magazines, where you're being paid a flat fee for a piece of work regardless of how much time it takes you to do it. Here, you're being paid for all your time. You may be giving that client a flat fee, but you've calculated how many hours you think it's going to take. And the fact is, corporations have more money than publications do. So, this is a matter of almost like going where the money is, in writing.
You just raised a question in my mind about the publications.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's safe to assume that whole printed market, the magazines, yeah, and journals and those kind of things are struggling in this new economy. Does that mean that there's less opportunity or more opportunity for a copywriter freelancer?
That's a good question. There is no question that the magazine market and newspaper market is going through a bloodbath right now, and a lot of it is moving to online, and the online content has become devalued to the point of, most of it's just absolute crap, and the people that are I probably get a lot of heat from people who are writing in that market, because frankly there's a lot of writers who are good writers who don't know about fields like mine, who are basically selling themselves so short. They're selling themselves for literally $5 and $10 an article, you know, for 500 word articles. Okay, that's a whole different arena than the one I'm in, and people try to lump all writing together and saying, well, writing is really bad right now here and here. It's like, well, yeah, it is. And it's not like our field has emerged completely unscathed. And as people lose jobs with newspapers, they may turn more to commercial freelancing. But still, it takes a certain skill set. It's like anything in the world. You get paid more when you're better at something that not the whole world is good at. Okay, it's a matter of setting yourself apart in the marketplace. And not everyone can write good marketing copy. But again, it's not that hard to do.
I figure if I spend an hour on Twitter, I could find a couple hundred thousand copywriters out there and freelance writers. Just like the photographer, you know, if you go buy a camera, people say, oh, I'm a photographer, hire me. Mm-hmm. Give us some advice to those that want to make a serious run at this kind of a business. What are some things you should do to set yourself apart from that, the rest of that mass out there?
Right. Well, you know, one of the things you have going for you in our field is that most of the people who are going to hire you are so overworked and so overextended, they don't want to spend a lot of time hunting around for a writer. So the more you can reach out, and I built my business cold calling, you know, and the idea of picking up the phone and calling a total stranger is completely terrifying to most people, except, you know, and I have a whole chapter in the book where I talked about trying to get people comfortable with that idea. But it's like, reach people, you know, in all the places that they are, like direct mail, like the phone, like email, maybe Twitter, LinkedIn, whatever. Raise your profile in the industry so that, you know, so that you are in front of them more often than somebody else. I mean, it's amazing how many times I will hear from clients how few copywriters they hear from. You know, so it's not like, you know, it's not like they're always, you know, their door is being beaten down. So and that's true for any field in that sense. You know, the one who's going to get the business is the one who's going to be more persistent and all that. And of course, over time, the one who's going to keep the business is the one who's good and who's reliable and who's dependable and who makes that company bottom line better and raises their reputation in the marketplace.
Yeah, the bottom line is it's the bottom line.
Exactly. Exactly. So
tell us about the book.
Okay, The Well-Fed Writer, and that's wellfedwriter.com, in case anyone's online. The new book is the updated version of the original 2000 edition combined with the content from 2005 companion volume, Well-Fed Writer, Back for Seconds. And this one kind of updates the work, and it's basically a very detailed how-to guide to help someone start a freelance commercial writing business. And it assumes nothing on the part of the reader other than you know you're a good writer, and you know that because someone other than your mother told you so, and you want to make a good living at it. And other than that, it really covers absolutely everything from soup to nuts, why it's a good field, what skills you need, what you should charge, how you should collect your money, who you should be contacting, what you should say when you contact them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So
how can our listeners find this book? What's the best way to get in touch with you and find out about this book and your work?
Again, wellfedwriter.com will kind of get you into a whole wealth of resources, including the book and including a bunch of free resources. The book, of course, is not free, but I think it's reasonable. But I have a free newsletter, and I have a free blog and a knowledge base. And Stone and I were talking earlier. I've started a group coaching program for people starting out in the business, and I've got another session starting up in June.
Is that an online course or face-to-face?
It's teleseminar.
Oh.
It's completely teleseminar, and all the sessions are recorded so for immediate download afterwards, so you can kind of access them again. But it's a great way to kind of throw yourself into it for a relatively low price and get your concerns answered and questions answered and all that. But if people are actually serious about it, I'd suggest, you know, pick up the book first and, take a test drive and see if it's something that is a fit for you. So,
well, say a little bit more about the coaching practice, if you will, because I know a lot of our listeners and quite a few guests that come through the show, they're business people. A lot of them are business authors. And, I mean, let's be candid. They're struggling with their marketing. You know, they've got a garage full of books. And I think they would all do well, of course, to get a copy of the book. But I'd like to hear a little bit more about this this coaching program. Can you lay out a little bit about the logistics and what happens?
Yeah. Again, it's for people who've decided, okay, I'm a good writer. I'd like to make extra income in terms of a part-time, or they really want to go full-time with it. And I've been doing one-on-one coaching for about 8 years, and I finally decided, let me try this other one. And because people starting out have a lot of the same issues and a lot of the same concerns and fears and all that, I decided to try this in a group setting. So I limit it to 12 people, and we meet for 4 sessions, 4 weeks in a row, and everybody submits 5 questions or concerns that they have about getting started. And then we use those as a basis for the discussion, and we just kind of take it from there. And the feedback, and I've got a bunch of testimonials on the site. The feedback's been pretty strong. People just feel like, there's a lot of fear. There's a lot of misconceptions. There's a lot of, bad information floating around. And this is a way to sort of ground people a little bit in terms of what you really need to get started and what the things you should be worrying about and the things you shouldn't be worrying about. Because too often when people start out, they worry about dumb things and they don't worry about the important things.
I bet they learn a lot from each other as well. That's what has me a little bit enamored with this group concept.
I've had a couple of the sessions. I've had three full sessions since November, and a couple of them we actually had a few people who were a little more experienced. They'd been in the business a couple of years, and those people could share a little more in the trenches. But everybody, whether everybody is coming from some industry and some background, and so they all have something to contribute to the discussion, and that's really and a number of these groups have kept in touch afterwards, and because some of them even set up like Google group discussion chat rooms to kind of to share information and all that, and that's really important because freelancing is a solitary profession, and you can sometimes feel like you're all alone out there. And something like this really makes you feel like, wow, okay, I'm not. There's other people in the same boat with the same concerns that I have. And
that fellowship is so important.
It really is, and especially that kind of like especially the talking. I mean, we're such a virtual society. It just anytime you can actually, at the very least, have people talking to each other, even if they're not face to face, but ideally face to face. And that's one of the things I tell people. Get out from behind your computer. Go out, take a walk, meet people. Come on, that's no life sitting behind a
Human interaction does lead to business.
It does. And that's why, cold calling, as much as people hate the idea of it, is very effective. It's one of the most, it's cut to the chase. I mean, it's not this roundabout. It's like, if you get somebody on the phone, they're either interested or they're not, and you can take it to the next step from there. So, and it's not that scary.
So. We're about out of time, but a couple more questions before we close out your segment, if we could. One, you mentioned some misconceptions that so many seem to have when they come into this coaching situation or start to try to pursue this type of business. What are a couple of mistakes that you see people make or misconceptions that they have that you see over and over?
Yeah. Well, one of them is, I've got to have the perfect website. I've got to have the perfect portfolio. And especially when it comes to, no question, you got to have some things in your portfolio. No one's going to hire you if you have, two things, one of them something from the church newsletter or something. That's probably not going to happen, but there's this idea of, remember, I tell people, we're writers. We're not designers, photographers, illustrators, animators, whatever. We're writers. You don't have to have a whiz-bang website. You have to have a website that, shows your samples in a reasonably expeditious fashion, and it doesn't have to be fancy. It just needs to get the job done. And over time, if you want to turn in that into a whiz-bang, but don't get too crazy with it, down the road, by all means, do that. I think also there's some misconceptions about in the writing world. You say the term copywriting, and it has some negative connotations because there's a whole bunch of quote unquote copywriting gurus out there who are in the realm of what's called direct response copywriting. This is the kind of stuff that you get, like nutritional supplements, these 20-page things with these bold, shocking claims, the 10 things doctors don't want you to know, you know, kind of thing. And or, you know, or the real estate investing, you know, ones like that. And so people, and so that the term has been co-opted. And so people think, oh, copywriting, I don't want to do that. Okay. Well, you know, by very reliable estimates, that arena of writing constitutes about 3% of the entire copywriting universe. The rest is, you know, working for respectable companies. Not that these companies aren't respectable, but some people just frankly aren't comfortable writing in that very hypey style. And so if somebody isn't, I say, you know, there's a ton of work out there that's, you know, low key, that it's about communication and just, you know, conveying information. And yes, usually persuasively, but not in a, you know, beat somebody over the head kind of way, in brochures and direct mail and ads and, you know, even newsletters and case studies and things like that. Very, very soft sell kind of stuff. It's not, you know, it's basically about helping a company put their best foot forward, you know, and doing it in a tasteful way. Because these days, and I'm sure you've seen this, Todd, people don't want to be sold, you know, they want to be educated. And so that's why things like white papers and case studies are growing in importance, because people want, you know, people want to read something and go, interesting, I've been informed, I've been educated. And it has a little marketing spin to it at the same time, but they don't want to feel like they've been. So the trends are in favor of that more low-key person anyway. So
good stuff. I'm glad I asked.
Yeah. Good question. It was a good question. Yeah. It was a good question.
Well, before we let you go, Peter, we have a little tradition here on the High Velocity Radio Show. We like to ask each guest.
Do I get dunked or something? Like the floor is going to open up underneath me?
You have to sing. No. We like to ask each guest if they would to share a mistake that they've made at some point in their career, and really more importantly, what they feel like they've learned from it. Could we get you to do that for us?
Oh, man, you're going to really put me on the spot here. I would say that probably the biggest mistake I made when I was starting out in this business is thinking I wasn't good enough to work for some of these big companies. And like when I first started out, I mean, you know, to work for UPS or Bell South or Coca-Cola or you know, it's like, I'm not good enough for them. And then then thankfully I managed to actually get in kind of by the side door into most of these companies by glomming onto a graphic designer, you know, and oftentimes graphic designers. I mean, it's like that's incidentally a very, you know, bona fide strategy for building your
good
business.
Group of people to use for our own purposes, graphic designers.
Yeah, because and vice versa. But you know, if you can walk,
but a lot of them are freelance too.
And so exactly.
That's
and hungry
have,
maybe.
If they have an entree into an organization, that's how you can.
Right, and if you can walk into an organization and say, hey, we can take this project from start to finish, you know, then you've become a problem solver. You're not just a writer. You know, you're a solution. You're not just, you know, a vendor kind of thing. And then once I got in the door of these companies, you realize, you know, these people are people like anywhere else. I mean, some of them are really smart. Some of them are really stupid. You know, most of them are overextended. And you realize that you really can make a difference for these people if you're a reasonably good writer and have some marketing chops and all that. So I'd say don't put them, you know, so the lesson is don't put these companies on a pedestal and think you can't make a difference for them, because chances are you can't.
Well, that's very encouraging advice. Don't sell yourself short.
There you go.
Absolutely. Well, it's been an absolute delight having you on the show,
Thank
Peter.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Would like
me.
To have you come back sometime, because I know that you have some very definitive opinions about how to approach publishing
yes.
your work.
Yeah, I'm a self-publisher, and I've written The Well-Fed Self-Publisher, and that's a... That's a whole other discussion for all the coaches and speakers and everyone else out there who hasn't written a book and knows they need to write a book. And that can self-publishing is really the smart way to go on something like that.
So. Well, we'll definitely have you back and have that conversation as well.
Sounds
good. Can you hang out with us for a little while we visit with our next guest?
Absolutely.
All right. Who'd you bring with you, Todd?
Well, I'm excited about our next guest on High Velocity. She is a speaker, an author, a trainer. She's the CEO of Performance Solutions by Design, and she also hails in her past from one of the premier customer experience organizations on the planet. Welcome to the show, Theo Jamison.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Glad you made it.
I am too.
You had to navigate through the wonderful world of Atlanta freeway system, so glad you survived. So welcome. It was good to see you again. It's been too long. Tell us a little bit about Performance Solutions by Design.
Well, it is a consulting firm that is unique because it launched as many companies wanting to duplicate or replicate some of the best practices of the Ritz-Carlton. And while I work with the Ritz-Carlton, I was the Vice President of Training and Organizational Effectiveness and also launched the Ritz-Carlton Leadership Center. And in doing that, got an opportunity to travel the world. People would always ask, how does the Ritz-Carlton do all these great things? So we would share that. And when I left the company, there was just a lot of enthusiasm around people wanting to replicate some of those best practices. So that's how we got started, was with helping other organizations, be it healthcare or legal services or hospitality or whatever the case may be, in their own way, replicate some of the best practices of the Ritz-Carlton.
So what do they do differently in their core mission? And it has to come from the leadership. And mm-hmm. So there's obviously a commitment to this. But why are they different than so many other organizations?
I think what makes them different is consistency, is being dedicated to ensuring that every lady and gentleman, and that's what the Ritz-Carlton refers to their employees as, but that every lady and gentleman is engaged around the vision and mission of the organization. And that they are a part of the organization, not just working for it. And then very good processes that are consistently driven by leadership to ensure that every guest has a memorable experience. And just simple things. As a matter of fact, the book that we wrote really is around what are those six simple principles that could help any world-class organization or any organization achieve world-class success.
You made a key statement there that I want to talk about. You said, really, it's simple things. It's deciding you want to do something and then doing it.
Mm-hmm.
How come so many organizations just seem to struggle with that? I do a lot of reading in this space, in the marketing and best practices and all that, and they say you got to get good people around you. And is it fair to say that a lot of organizations either don't commit to or struggle to find the right kind of people? And how do you find these people? What steps do you have to take? I suspect that's one of the things you do for your clients is to help them figure that problem out.
Right. You know, most organizations are looking for a quick fix. They're looking for something that what they'd like for us to do is come in, what we call wave the magic fairy wand and the fairy dust, give people a good training experience and then walk away. But that's just not sustainable. What we found out is that, that's kind of surface. If an organization really wants to elevate the customer experience, it has to be, first of all, clarified in their, what we call their service philosophy and their vision and their mission and even in their business objectives, and that they need to select employees around that. If you are an organization and one of your values is high integrity or compassion for others, respect, then that needs to be articulated in your vision and mission. And then along with selecting people that have all the technical skills that make an organization run, they also must have those key characteristics that will help them bring the vision and mission of the organization to life.
Do you find that some companies or some industries have a more of a challenge around customer service and excellence than others? And if so, what kinds of challenges do you see?
I think that the organizations or industries that find it a little easier are those like healthcare, hospitality, because a big component of what they do is make people feel better. When you get into engineering and manufacturing, it's a harder sell because, you know, they feel that at the end of the day, I'm just making a widget.
Right.
You know, but with those type of organizations, it's easy for them to remember that everyone has a customer, even if it's an internal customer, and that even the same level of dignity and respect that we treat our external customers, the customer that will be purchasing whatever your product or service is, it starts with having that type of environment, internal customer to internal customer, employee to employee.
How long have you been on your own and separated from the Ritz?
Since 2003, so almost 6.5 years.
Hey, this might work out for you.
Yeah.
I would hope so. You might make a go of this thing, Theo.
I would hope so at this point. I was with the Ritz-Carlton for 17 years and never imagined that I would be doing this on my own, but it just kind of happened by chance. And I think I always had an entrepreneurial spirit in me. Even when I was with the Ritz-Carlton, I kind of figured that whatever area or job that I was in, I didn't own the company, but I owned that job. So I always tried to make sure that whatever I did within that the capacity of that job, I did it with excellence. And that's what, you know, that's what we're all about, is helping organizations realize that the key to customer loyalty and the key to sustainable profitability is in the experience that the customer consistently has, you know, and that's what keeps them coming back and wanting to spend more.
Now, you and I occasionally try to get together, have a cup of coffee and catch up, but it usually takes us about 6 months to arrange it because you're always on the road traveling, yeah. Speaking. Tell us about some of the things that you do when you're out in the road and you're speaking to an organization. What are the lessons that you're teaching? What programs are you doing?
All sorts of things. There are times when we are working specifically with senior leadership because we know that creating a culture of excellence has a trickle-down effect. If the president of the organization, the CEO, the C-level, the C-suite people aren't engaged around it and don't believe in it, then it won't be sustainable. So many times we're meeting with senior leadership. Sometimes we're training middle management. And oftentimes we're working with frontline employees on what are those simple things that we need to do with a high level of consistency that will engage the customer and make them a lifetime loyal customer. So we go around doing that, training, and also consulting, helping organizations with either developing or refining their vision and mission, their business objectives. What are the standards of excellence that everyone will deliver consistently every day that will create that great customer experience? So with consulting, keynote speeches, training, and then I love to write too. So I kind of feel like that's a, I don't know if that's a disease. I write every day. So I don't know, but I write every day. So just always looking at how to better educate customers and clients on what are those simple things that they can do that it doesn't take a lot of money. And people think that because you came from the Ritz-Carlton, they had a lot of money, but that many of the things that we did didn't cost anything. You know, a smile doesn't cost anything.
Okay, well, there's some, correct me if I'm going to get this wrong, and I'm sure you'll correct me, but there's some sort of a rule. I don't know if rule is even the right word. It goes against what that culture is about. But where any interaction with a Ritz employee is followed by "it's my pleasure" or something like that.
Absolutely.
Am I have that right?
Yeah, you sure do.
That doesn't cost any money to do that, does it?
It doesn't. Go ahead.
But why are so many organizations not have something that obvious and basic? I just don't understand that.
Because they think that's too basic. When we come in and we tell them that, you know, if you want to engage the customer, think about the three steps of service, that when a customer comes in, they should always get a warm welcome. We should always not only comply with their needs, but anticipate what they haven't asked for and do that for them, and that they should always get a fond farewell. And to most companies, they're like, that's impossible.
It's not complicated enough to work.
Right. You're kidding me. It's more than that. And we've got to spend $1 trillion on it, which we don't have. So, you know, it's kind of getting them to back to the basics is what makes it so difficult for some organizations. They want something that's complex. And we know that excellence is driven by consistency and simplicity. And I've seen it happen time and time again.
Now, does the machinations of the social web and Twitter and blogs and Facebook and all, does that complicate this, what you try to do, or does that make it easier for organizations to do that?
I think that in organizations that embrace all of those things, it actually makes it easier because the generation of workers that are out there today, they're accustomed to, you know, social media and YouTube and, you know, the internet and e-learning. And so we try to dabble in a little of all of that. The learner, we have to look at the various ways that people learn and that people are engaged and ensure that the message of the company, you know, is communicated in all of those different avenues.
Well, I can tell you from personal experience, when you and I, Todd, went to the Video Dust Jacket tour, we went to Orlando, stayed at a beautiful property, and they were marketing through Twitter. That's how we found the property. And that experience over the phone with that woman was marvelous. She was great. Then I actually spoke to someone on the property. That was a great experience. But the people on the property had not been up, not been brought up to speed on the Twitter presence. So there was a disconnect in the situation really well, but there was a disconnect. So I'm sure that you have to do something and be cognizant of that and make sure everybody knows. If we're going to use this social media, we got to get everybody up to speed on it.
Yeah, and there's still a lot of organizations out there that are intimidated by social media.
Right.
And I don't know if it's because when you look at the people that are at the C-level, they may not be quite as adept. So they're a little intimidated, and sometimes they don't want to go out on a limb or take a risk. But I think that when you look at driving excellence and communicating how that's done and creating alignment, all the things that we want to do, that certainly social media and all of this stuff is just a wonderful way to do it.
Well, I'll tell you what I envision, and I may very well have this wrong. Sometimes I do. Todd and I were going to open up a sandwich shop. What I envision is, so we hire somebody like you, and you and your team mm-hmm. come in, and we just sit around and think through, okay, what do we want to happen to that customer? How do we want them to think? Stations and sort of map that out with your clients?
Yes, we do. You know, and again, just how simplistic it is and just how hard it is for people to connect with that. Our first question would be, what do you want the customer to feel, to leave with? What do you want them to do, to feel, to know, do, or feel when they are experiencing, your product or service? We want them to know that the customer is first. We want them to feel, you know, like either this is their home away from home or that we will take care of them or have confidence in us. And, you know, one of the things that we want them to do is have such a great experience that they continue to tell other people because word of mouth is so powerful. So as simplistic as that is, a lot of people have trouble. What do we want people to know, do, or feel? What do you mean, Theo? But it really starts with that. It's simple stuff. And all the time people say, Theo, you say it's simple stuff because you do it every day. But I think sometimes we create complexity around simple things. At the end of the day, the customer wants to feel valued. The customer wants to get a great product, and they want to support the organization. They want to spend their money somewhere where they feel valued.
Okay, so in the scenario of the Stone and Todd sandwich shop, Stone fancies himself a good cook, but he's really not. So he makes a lousy sandwich, and the customer is upset.
I use a lot of hot sauce.
Everything you make tastes like hot sauce. So the customer has a bad experience. How do you teach the organization to deal with someone who's had a bad experience? And that's a critical element of this process, too.
It's a very important process because customers don't expect us to always be right, but we've made a mistake. It's caused an issue or a problem for them. They want it resolved right away. So the way that we train it is that you should always listen. You know, don't interrupt. Typically, first listen. Then empathize. Well, I apologize. Apology doesn't mean that we're wrong, but that we are putting ourselves in your shoes. Ask, how can we fix this? You know, well, you can fix this by giving me another sandwich with no mayo on it. And then in the end, produce. Fix the sandwich. Thank the customer. You think about how many customers walk away, never complain, never come back. And how many customers have a bad experience, and they tell 10 times the amount of people as when they have a great experience. So we try to teach. It's very simple and basic. Listen. Don't listen with the intent to defend yourself, but listen with the intent to be able to empathize and then ask how we can fix it and then produce a solution. Because sometimes, you know, the way that the customer wants to be prohibited, well, you can fix it by giving me $1 million. It's just a crazy example. But, ask and then maybe, well, I apologize. We can't give you $1 million, but here's what we can do. And if you follow those simple steps, the customer 99% of the time will be satisfied. But people focus on the 1%. We think all day about the one grumbling grouch that came in one time this month. We had 30 days in a month, and we forget about the other 30 days where 900 or 1,000, 2,000 people came in, and they were highly satisfied with how we resolved the issue.
Well, and you can win a customer for life if they, based on how they perform in that situation. Everybody can be great when everything's flowing smooth.
Yes.
But when you run into a problem and then they demonstrate that they really do care and they're willing to go that extra mile, I mean, you can win a customer for life like that.
Oh, a much better chance to build a long-term loyal customer that way than someone who just has an average experience that doesn't go wrong or great.
Well, and even what you said earlier, let's say the customer's dead wrong. Mm-hmm. You didn't do anything wrong. You can still apologize for the situation or how it made them feel or the fact that things are not going their way.
Right.
And that goes, I mean, that's huge.
I think your key word there, Theo, is the empathy.
Yeah.
I mean, you're right. So many businesses come at that approach with the defensive. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's a great way to think about it. I'm going to use that.
And sometimes it's not even our fault. They're upset because they were on 400, Georgia 400, and they're in traffic. And now they get to you, and they're going to be late. And, you know, So now, you know, it may not even be...
We've never experienced that.
So we try to teach people that it may not even be you. But at the end of the day, empathy is really about putting yourself in that person's shoes and saying, if that were me, how would I like to be treated? And we always like to think about problem resolution. If it were your grandmother, how would you like for someone to treat your grandmother? Would you like them to be accusatory? Well, you're wrong and we're not going to give you your money back. There's always this thing. There's always this thing in the back of employees' minds that everyone is out to rip us off. And in most cases, people just want their problem simply resolved without an argument that they feel good with, and they'll go on their merry way. And what we don't realize is that people that have a memorable experience, even if we turned it around from a bad experience, they are equally 11 times more likely to recommend us, to use us again, and to spend more money with us. So that's the important thing for people to remember.
I love the way she framed it up. How would you want your grandmother to be treated?
Yes.
I mean, that would...
It's a great way to think about it.
Again, it's not complicated enough to work, but it's a neat idea.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
But, you know, simple apology sometimes is all you have to do. Someone just wants to know that you feel bad about that they had a bad experience.
A simple apology and leave it at that. How many times you get the simple apology and then the long, drawn-out explanation of why? Customer doesn't care why. I don't care that so-and-so didn't show up for work, so now we're behind. And customer doesn't care. I apologize. How can we fix this and move forward?
Now,
isn't the average person just waiting to forgive you?
Yes. I so much agree.
You know, they just want to say, okay, fine, because they're so used to bad customer service.
Yeah. How often you go to return something? I had to go and return a laptop, and you almost go in the store already with your defenses on.
Because when they say this
is what I'm going to say, and I'm going to do this, and, you know. And then you get in there, and they're like, oh, I'm sorry that happened. How can we fix that? And you're like, whoa, you're speechless, you know. And they fix it, and then you feel good, and you tell 900 people about it.
Now, and it costs thousands and thousands of dollars of consulting to teach that.
Exactly, yes. Now, this is just between you and I, Theo, and a few thousand listeners, but have you found yourself ever in a client situation where there are policies or procedures or maybe even some unwritten sort of cultural norms in the organization that make it very difficult for the individual to put what you're talking about into action without suffering some repercussions or anything like that?
We find that, and that's why it has to be a culture of excellence. You have to create a culture where people feel comfortable, going to each other and saying that, you know, Theo, the way that you handled that, that's not the way that we should, and making it a teaching moment, and the person feeling okay with that. It has to be a culture where leaders are 100% you know, behind the culture of the organization. I've worked in organizations way prior to the Ritz where I had a leader one time, I was working in retail, said, you need to smile when you meet with every customer. And he had the biggest frown on his face and he was almost yelling. You know, so that really wasn't the culture.
Yeah, right.
You know, so again, it goes back to, we were just working with a large healthcare organization in Mount Kisco, New York, and helping them because they're working around this patient-centered care approach. And they went back to the fact that it's the little things that make the difference. That's really what it's all about.
You said earlier that you write every day. Well, you've written two books. Why don't you tell us a little about those books?
All right. My first book, The Six Principles of Service Excellence, and that's really what we're known for, that was written because people would always ask us, what are those secrets of the Ritz? What are those things that they do? So we had these six things. But what we wanted to do was to extend beyond the Ritz-Carlton because people always say, well, it's a luxury company and they've got a lot of money to throw into things. And we wanted to look across other industries. So not only did we study the Ritz, which was easy since we'd worked there for a long time, but we looked at Disney. This may not be a good one as an example at this point, but a couple of years ago, Toyota was known as a world-class organization when it came to processes. So back then, we looked at them. We looked at Nordstrom's, because you always hear the tire story about how someone took some tires to Nordstrom's and they took them back and they don't even sell tires.
Right.
So, which, by the way, happens to not be true. Talk to a person from Nordstrom's and they're like, no, that never happened, but it's
cool
a good story, so we, you know, let it continue. But we looked at these organizations and we found that they had certain things in common, one being that they have a simple, articulated vision and mission that helps everyone understand where the organization is going, what it wants to be, that everyone understands the four or three or five key objectives of the organization, and they understand how their work relates to it. Example might be at the Ritz. Even a dishwasher could tell you, what are the business objectives for this year? You know, in most organizations, once you get past the CEO and you know, a couple of vice presidents, nobody can tell you what the business objectives are. So, you know, the six principles is all about those six principles of service excellence that any organization, small or large, whether you're in manufacturing, healthcare, banking, legal services, hospitality, whatever, things that you can do to create an exceptional customer experience. And then the second book is the Leadership Book of Numbers. And that's because I write every day. We deal with a lot of leaders and always looking at what are things that they can do to improve their effectiveness. So I was working with another writer friend a couple of years ago, and he said, people like things around numbers. So one thing might be 10 ways to one is the top five ways to increase employee accountability. Another might be around five ways to improve your new employee orientation process. So it's 5, 10, 15. That's why it's called the Book of Numbers, because it's really around, numbers.
That's
so
great.
Yeah, so that's kind of unique, and we've got the second one coming out soon. But those are our two books, and I could probably write books until I'm 300 because I have all this information in my head. And I always feel better at the end of the day once I've, you know, being a writing expert. You would probably know, Peter. Mm-hmm. But once I get it out of my head, then it's, you know, and written down, then I can move on to the next thing. Sometimes I can't even move on until I get that out of head on paper. And so that's how these books happen.
So how does the process start? If whether I'm starting up a brand new business or I've had one in place for some time, how does the process start with you? Is it get on the phone with you and talk it through a little bit? Have you come out and visit our site? Walk us through, if you would, kind of a, if there is such a thing, a typical engagement or partnership with you and your firm.
Sure. Now, we're very lucky that 95% of our business is through word of mouth. So typically, another organization has worked with us, and so they'll recommend us to someone else. But what typically happens is a client will call us, because they've heard about us and they want. So what we try to do is follow our own practice. Seek first to understand, which is a Stephen Covey thing. Seek first to understand what their issue is. So we kind of lend them some time to tell us what the environment is going on, what they're trying to improve, and what they expect the what they want the expected outcomes to be. So we'll spend some time on a conference call with that. And then we'll do a little bit of prescribing. We'll, you know, we'd be happy to come in, and here are a couple of options. We always give our clients three options. We can do a customized consulting for you. We can do some off-the-shelf training for you. Or we can even train your people on how to create this culture of excellence. And based on their budget, their timing. With us, the lucky thing is that most clients need it done yesterday. So when they needed it done yesterday, they're like, we need you, and my colleague is Vivian. We need you to come in because we needed this done yesterday. And we can go in, spend a couple of days with them to learn their culture, give them advice on what needs to be improved in the culture based on a gap analysis. We have a six principles of service excellence gap analysis that will help them to determine what their strong points are, where the weaknesses are, and then we give them recommendations on how to close some of the gaps on those weaknesses and then move forward from there.
Well, and if you're smart, you get all this done before you hire Todd to make all your stuff look pretty, and, or you hire Peter or somebody in his crowd to write the copy to compel you to want to come. Or,
yes.
I mean, because the last thing you want to do is oversell and underdeliver, right?
Absolutely. And that's the best time is when it happens before an organization is launched, because that's, you know, an exciting time when the vision and mission, all of that is so strong with everyone, what we want to achieve, what legacy we want to leave behind. But probably in many cases, it's an existing organization. Most of our organizations, believe it or not, have been around for, that we work with, over 100 years, which is kind of interesting to me. You know, we've been around 135 years or 100 years. But that is key, is when you get that new organization that's just starting, because everything's so fresh.
Theo, the way you described your typical engagement, it came across as it was a relatively short-term engagement. Mm-hmm. Is that how typically it works? A lot of times I think you're fostering or trying to bring on a dramatic cultural shift, mm-hmm. as we talked about. That doesn't happen overnight, does it?
No, it doesn't happen overnight. Organizations that get the most benefit are those that have a 12 to 18 month strategy. And we've got quite a few organizations that we will work with over 12 to 18 months. Okay. And it depends on the level of expertise that they have internally. Sometimes they've got the wherewithal. They just need someone to help keep them on task, on point, give them a timeline. And then there are times when no one within the organization has the level of expertise. And in those situations, that's when we'll work with them for the long term.
So your firm will stay on board for that kind of a time frame to help with mid-course corrections and adjustments as they're going through that cultural change. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it has been an absolute delight having you on the show, Theo.
Great. Thank you. Well, it's over already. Oh, my God.
It goes quick, doesn't it?
Yes.
Listen, before we let you go, and you heard us do this with our earlier guest, mm-hmm. Peter Bowerman, we'd like to ask each guest, if they would, to share a mistake that they've made at some point in their career and mm-hmm. and for the benefit of our listeners to share with us what they feel like they learned from it. Can we con mm-hmm. you into doing that for us?
Sure, sure. You know, I thought about this driving in and I was like, I've never made a mistake. Everything I've done has always been planned. But then in listening to Peter, it made me think that I would probably say on my side, my biggest career mistake, I left a wonderful job with the Ritz-Carlton. I was vice president and everything. And when I moved on into my own organization, I just thought it would be an overnight success. You know, we'd be millionaires and trillionaires like within 30 days. And in realizing that and even launching a company, that it's not a short-term thing, that it takes time and that you've got to continually work at it and continually improve, continually refine. And that's how you have sustainability. So we've been around for 6 years, hope to be around another 106 years, but just that in the beginning, I thought that, like probably many other entrepreneurs, that, you know, you start your company tomorrow and you're going to be Microsoft in 60 days. Just doesn't happen like that.
What marvelous advice. And how encouraging is this, Todd, for all the entrepreneurs out there that feel like they want to get something going, both to hear from Peter and the success that he's had and all the neat stuff that Vivian and Theo are doing. I think you and I might even pull this thing off.
We might be able to pull this together. Hey, Theo, let our audience know how they can find you and connect with you.
All right. I am on Twitter. I have a blog. Our website is www.psbydesign.com, or you can just Google Theo Gilbert Jameson. So there are many ways to find us, and through that you can order our books. Other resources that we have, I think we're pretty easy to find on the internet.
Well, I've spent time on your website in the past, and you have all kinds of good information on there and seminars and white paper. I mean, you have all kinds of material. So if you liked what you heard today, you'll definitely want to go there, and there's a lot of material there for you to learn from. So.
And what's your Twitter handle?
Oh, my goodness.
It's Theo Jameson, at Theo Jameson.
At Theo Jameson.
Yeah. Thank you.
And both of your books, mm-hmm. as well as both the Peter Bowerman's books, No Trans Fat, mm-hmm. Deficit Neutral, and Gluten Free, all of these products, yes?
Love it, yes.
Well, what a great show. Until next time, this is Stone Payton, Todd Schnick, Peter Bowerman, Theo Gilbert Jameson, and the entire Radio X family saying we'll see you in the Fast Lane.